Glad to see my fame obviously preceded me, and that's why the crowd tonight. I'm a Dallas native. I grew up in Oak Cliff, Texas. I still live in Oak Cliff, Texas. I went to University of Dallas, graduated from UD in 1975 in psychology with a minor in philosophy. I went to Duquesne University in Pittsburgh because I was so enamored of my teachers at UD that I thought that Duquesne would be a great place to go. I went there and got a master's degree in clinical psychology. I noticed that there were a lot of people getting very, very old trying to finish their PhDs there. And I remember there was one gentleman who could not get his proposal accepted year after year after year because the committee kept saying that his phenomenon wasn't really a phenomenon. And I thought that sounds like it could be really bad for me, because I didn't want to get really old before I finished the PhD. So I left Duquesne, came back to Dallas, and started working in public mental health. Went into private practice started in 78, went into private practice in 83. Ever since, I have been doing a lot of individual and marital psychotherapy. Most people who do what I do, about a third of what they do, maybe even a half for some, is going to be working with relationships. So you get exposed to enough of this stuff and you stay married long enough, there are certain things that you learn that seem to be over and over again true of every relationship that walks in the door, including the relationship that you live in. So I began to kind of notice that over the years, I found myself saying the same things over and over again to people who were in treatment with me for relationship problems. And I began to kind of collate these and write them down. And they became a kind of a set of aphorisms, queries, statements, remarks, observations that I like to share with people. I hope that what we're going to do tonight is have more of a conversation than me stand here and talk to you for 30 or 45 minutes. So I want you to know from the beginning that you're free to interrupt, add to, take away, modify, question, tell me I'm wrong, because I don't care if I'm wrong. I mean, I'm not here to be right or wrong. I'm here to kind of stimulate some thinking about something that's very obvious and very common and very omnipresent in our world, the long-term committed relationship, also known as marriage. I mean, everybody has at least been in one or is in one. And there is tons of advice available about how to do it and how to do it good and how to make it better and how to solve problems and how to have better sex. But no one thinks to me, I have yet to come across anything that is more of an objective querying of what is this thing that we call marriage. So, I'm going to make my statements. Now I entitled this talk Towards an Existential Phenomenology. Well, now that's hanging some pretty fancy clothes on what I'm going to say tonight. But, I figured, hey, it's the Philosopher's Forum. I can't just show up and say, hey, I'm going to toss out some stuff about marriage and, see what you guys think about it. So we're going to call it Towards an Existential Phenomenology. All right. I was trained and educated in existentialism and phenomenology in college. Let's remember that existentialism is that way of thinking that asks us to understand that there is no transcendent reality that ultimately justifies what we do here on earth, that we give meaning to whatever it is we do. Oddly enough, this is exactly what the Zen people say in Zen. They call this thing that is before you, that is the entirety of creation, they call that Mu. What is Mu? Mu is this right now, and it is the entirety of all that is for you and for no one else. So, it's interesting to me to see that. I call this phenomenology because phenomenology is the study of experience. What is it like? What is the experience of being married. Not what is it should, what should it be, not what does the romantic myth say it is, but what is it really? And as we all know, what it really is a struggle. And let's be honest about that. And that's not to take away from it. That's not to diminish it. That's not to run it down. But let's to be truthful about it. It is a struggle. And it's a very, very worthwhile struggle. It's a struggle that's worth having. Sisyphus had his struggle. Sisyphus got in trouble with Zeus. Does anybody remember what Sisyphus did? He pulled some kind of a scam on Zeus. Tell me. Oh, that's right. It was. It was Hades. That's right. Yeah. Sisyphus was also a mortal farmer, and he was invading the land of the gods, right? And he got slapped down for overstepping his position. Very common theme in Greek mythology, Greek philosophy, you know, the sin of hubris, overstepping your own position in life. But Sisyphus got thrown into Hades and told that his job throughout eternity would be to roll this rock. Sisyphus eventually made his peace with the rock. It sound, you know, we talk about it, you know, it's in when we first come across the myth of Sisyphus, it always speaks to us as this humongously meaningless, onerous, terrible task to roll that rock up the hill every day. And yet it speaks to us so loudly and so clearly, because in so many ways that's exactly what our human lives are all about, to do the same thing in the same way day in and day out, and to somehow find a way to extract meaning from that experience, as did Sisyphus. So I think of the long-term committed relationship as being a Sisyphean task, of devoting ourselves completely to the task of being in this relationship, being who and what I am to that other person, while that other person does exactly the same thing with me. And out of that dialogue comes this third thing that we call the relationship that takes on a life of its own, which we alternately suffer with and rejoice in. And sometimes suffer and rejoice at the same time. The young person who is newly married always thinks that they've got it figured out, that they're not going to make the same mistakes that have been made before them. I have picked the right person. This is going to be a good marriage. This is going to be a good relationship. This isn't going to be like mom and dad's or the people across the street or my neighbors that are always fighting. This marriage is going to be a really good one. And then slowly but surely over time, there emerges this third entity, this unwieldy thing that they cannot get control of, that no one person has control of. No one. I don't have control of it, you don't have control of it. But somehow, in some kind of way, something snatches us both, and we both become miserable, and we fight. Or something snatches us both, and we have great, great sex. Or something grabs hold of us both, and we have the time, the unbelievable time of our lives, riding the roller coaster, or looking at the cliffs in Northern California. And no one person is responsible for that. It's that third thing that comes out of you and I. And again, you and I is something that was spoken of a lot in existentialism as well. But we won't elaborate that anymore. So, with that said, I will set before you my random, orderless, and scattered observations regarding relationships. And we're going to start with this first one. All relationships are screwed up. Not some, but all. And why is that? Because they're composed of human beings. Human beings trying to reinvent the wheel, trying to reinvent how to go forward with this collision of universes. I always think of marriage as this massive. You ever seen those deep space photographs that show these two huge star clusters, billions of stars colliding with one another? That's what marriage is. Marriage is this epic collision of two universes coming closer and closer and closer and closer and closer, and as they do, there is this friction, this inevitable friction that causes power struggles and misery and misunderstanding and difficulty and pleasure and sadness and divorce and violence, emotional violence, physical violence, verbal violence. Who hasn't called their husband or wife a bad name? Right? That's violence. All relationships are screwed up. And what does this mean? Okay, if you've made the Camus decision to not commit suicide or to not end the relationship and decided to go on with the relationship, it implies certain things that you're obliged to do. One of the things that you're obliged to do is, as a member of that screwed up relationship, your lifelong task is to work at unscrewing the relationship, whether the other person is doing the same thing or not at exactly the same time as you. And that's a problem for most of us, because the child in us wants to go, but she's not doing anything, or he's not picking up, or, you know, whatever that might be. But it requires, if you have said to yourself, I want this relationship to work, then there are certain things you have to do. You have to work at unscrewing the relationship in your own way, as best you can. What does that usually mean? I think that over the long haul, what it really means is being who you are, being clear with yourself and the other person as best you possibly can, who and what you are. And that's a process that takes time. No one knows how to completely expose their own soul to another person when they're 24. When you're 24, you're not in the business of exposing your soul to others. You're in the business of exposing just how awesome you are when you're 24. Right? Just how fantastic you really are when you're 24. Any comments? Queries? Interrupt? Yes. I think of it as the intrusion of consciousness into instinct. Because consciousness can create these rules. Now, there was someone who had reacted rather strongly. Did you want to say something? Yes. Okay. You said a lot, by the way, without saying a word.
You did that a lot.
You can't hear me? Oh, okay. All relationships, this is a corollary, all relationships are messes. In other words, they're unwieldy. They are disorganized. They are never the same thing 2 days in a row. And there are people who want to devote themselves to cleaning up the mess, to getting it organized, to getting everything in its right compartment, to doing things that are normal. Let's have a normal relationship. And usually that person who wants to have a normal relationship is attracted to and usually tries to bond with people who have absolutely no interest whatever in a normal relationship. So what I've learned over the years is that if your intention is to make these things last, what has to be done is that there has to be a succumbing to the mess. I call it dropping into the mess, letting it completely cover you with its messiness. Reach out to that partner, grab hold, and form a partnership with that person that says, let's you and I together see if we can't figure out a way to straighten this thing up. To live with this mess, live in this mess, clean up this mess, tolerate this mess, make it a better mess, make it a worse mess, but somehow, let's you and I together do something about this mess. Now, what that means is that until we finally discovered that our only ally in the problem of the relationship is the partner, what happens in the meantime? Power struggle. Lots and lots of power struggling. You always do this, you never do that. Why do you have to do the X, Y, or Z? Why do we have to do this, that, and the other thing? Who says that you're in charge of the money? Who says that you're in charge of the household? Who says that you get to pick what? You know, finally, what you learn is if you're going to learn anything at all, is that your ally in that struggle is sitting right there arguing with you, disagreeing with you. And it really works, you know, if the other person has a similar discovery at about the same time. Now, I couch all of this in terms of if you want the relationship to go forward. I'm not here to tell you how to make it better or how to, I'm not Dr. Phil giving relationship tips or how to improve things. This is all under the heading of if you want it to survive, if you want it to be a place that is workable and livable for you. That's it. Okay, let's move along. Yes.
I guess aside from.
Yeah, that's a good question. What do you think? See, I'm a therapist. Remember, I always get you to answer first.
Here.
Ah, very good. I like that. And we seek, and I actually kind of get to that later on, but we seek the relationship in order to be who we really are. And we can't really discover who or what that is until we have that mirror that can give me back to me. I like that. Very good. And you're not appealing to anthropology either. You could, but you didn't. We cannot go back in our relationships. A lot of times when people find themselves in a terrible struggle and are uncertain about how to go forward, one of the things that we do is we go back. We start thinking, well, when was it good when we first got married? Why can't we be like it was when we first got married or when we were in our first house or when the first child was born or whatever? You know, we always want to go back, and we have to understand that there is no going back. Evolution only goes in one direction. It goes into the future. The purpose of commitment to the other person and to the relationship is to be free. And this kind of goes to what Mark was talking about. To be free to be who and what I am. And to share that with the other. In other words, we both enter into this contract to be who and what we are, to pursue our individual freedom. Does that mean to be impulsive or to act out, as we say in psychology? No, it means to be free, to bring your true self into the world, and to do everything that you possibly can to engage that with the world. What I owe my partner is the results of my own exploration of my destiny. To me, destiny and the true self are interchangeable. They're to say one is to say the other. So I don't use it in terms of that thing out there towards which we tend, which is what destiny means. But what it actually what I mean is when I say destiny is true self, to enact all of who and what I am and bring it into the world. Yes.
I definitely think the real problem is self-centered.
Okay. Okay. Everybody hear the comment? Yeah. So his comment is that the successful long-term relationship is where each side comes to the understanding that the best way to go forward is to be of service to the other side, to the other person. Self-sacrifice. Yeah, I think this gentleman's observation had to do with the fact that if I understand bringing my true self into the world as being granting the child in me or the inauthentic self in me or the ego in me its whims and fancies and impulses, then that's going to create problems, which of course it does. And we can all think back to early in marriage and remember those times when you were doing that as well. I can remember when I was doing that, where it was much more important to me to do something that was social or something that was fun or something that I thought would aggrandize me rather than to pay attention to the real obligations I created for myself at home. But I think that for what my proposal is that the authentic self is something that slowly emerges over time. It's not fully formed, nor is it ever fully formed, I don't believe. It's always in process, but it does not emerge early in marriage. It emerges later on. But it starts early on with those youthful projects of, I want to be this, or I want to be that, or I want to try, I want to make this, or I want to be an astronaut, or a fireman, or a psychotherapist, or whatever. And that comes out slowly over time. And the place within which to do that is of course, in the long-term committed relationship that we've created, and which is a mess, and which I am slowly but surely working at cleaning up or making it a tolerable mess. Yes. Yeah.
And I'm just kind of curious. You've been practicing. I mean, have you seen?
Yeah. Right. Well, you know, it's first off, you know, narcissism is a word that gets thrown around a lot. You know, and also it's in the present moment, one of the worst things that you can call someone is a narcissist. You know, if you really want to, you know, you call them a narcissist and you've delivered a knockout blow there. But let's remember that the narcissist, the clinical definition of the narcissist is the person whose vision or picture of himself or herself is so deeply flawed that they have completely engaged themselves in the creation of this external facade that they ask everyone to relate to. And it's kind of like, you know, the funny little man in the booth in The Wizard of Oz. You know, pay no attention to the funny little man in the booth. Look at the Great Oz. And we have to understand that the true narcissist is a person who is deeply troubled, suffers intensely day in and day out, and does not live a happy life. And so, you know, to live in this narcissistic culture, I don't know. I mean, you know, you can remember in the 80s, the 80s was all about surfaces, entirely about gorgeous, glimmering, slick, shiny surfaces, whether it was music or video or whatever form of culture we're talking about. So, you know, you can say that 80s culture was narcissistic. You can say that American culture and the cult of the individual and individualism certainly tends us towards narcissism. But I think we have to remember that underneath what that surface is someone who is always suffering. Now, I don't know if that answers your question, Jack, but that's what I'm going to say about it. Sure, I cleared that mess up for you, didn't I? Anybody else? Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Talk a lot. I mean, that's how you do it. You talk a lot. And you work things. I mean, that's the thing that has to happen. I spend, you know, when I'm doing marriage therapy, you know what I try to do? You know what I'm doing? I'm not, my operation is sit over to one side and try to make people talk to each other about whatever faces them. And then say, let's hope that this conversation that you've had here today continues when you get home. Because these are very, very powerful forces that are going on. People are truly pulled to accomplish things that may or may not help the relationship survive. So you have to talk to one another and say, here's what it is I want to do. How can we work this out? Yes. You shouldn't. There's no reason to. I said if you... Yeah. Yeah. Right. Well, I'm not saying you should suffer. I'm not promoting it by any stretch of the imagination. Yeah. Yeah. And then come to hate her and then start over again. Yeah. Get her to hate you. And yeah, no, let me remind you that I'm not here to say this is what you should be doing. You know, that you should be going out and getting married and having long, happy marriages. Because there are a lot of people who shouldn't be doing it. Like, probably you shouldn't be doing it. I mean, really. I mean, and that's not a, you know, that's just, some people shouldn't do it. That's all there is to it. It's not for everybody. It's only for those who, you know, are have the makeup and the willingness and the interest for whatever the reason. I think, you know, I've been married for 35 years, and I spent the first half of that trying to get divorced. You know, and something kept pulling me back, you know, and it was this mysterious thing. I'm not promoting that suffering is good. What I'm saying, suffering comes with the things that we choose to do, that we commit ourselves to. For instance, the Buddhists, you know, they're who knows suffering better than the Buddhists? What they say is to exist is to suffer. Suffering and existence are exactly the same thing. Once we acknowledge that and accept that to suffer, to exist is to suffer, then that suffering becomes tolerable, and we even begin to find meaning in it. Now, does that mean, again, do I promote suffering? Do I promote that you hit your hand with a hammer? Say that again now? Oh. Yeah. You know, about half of what you do in marriage counseling is divorce counseling. Because, I mean, because here's the truth of it. Most people, when they come to marriage counseling, they're kind of like the people that put their dead cat in an ice chest, go up to the vet and say, can you do something with this? Right. Yeah, that's why I say it's a mess. Yeah, yeah, it is. Absolutely. I mean, it's an artificial construct. I mean, marriage is a rule-driven relationship. It's a contract. It's a legal contract. And that the only entity in the world that creates things like that is us, because we have consciousness. For a while, yeah, for a while. Absolutely. Yes.
So my first marriage, I was married 19 years, and I had high expectations of great happiness. And I did not achieve that. In my second marriage, I have lower expectations, and I'm much happier. So can you speak about this? Maybe it has to do with age or experience, but to not expect this pure bliss, and so you're not disappointed.
Right.
Can you talk about that?
Well,
what is your thought about
it
that?
Sounds like you accepted that it's a mess, and that she and I are both going to get into this mess together, and we're going to figure out how to be in this mess as partners. Now, sometimes you can do that in your first marriage. Actually, I think I'm married the same woman for 35 years. I'm probably in about my 10th or 12th marriage with her. Because each time there's this horrendous conflict, something about that old relationship burns off, you know, and there's this reemergence of new stuff, new tissue, however you want to think about it, right? So, you figured out how to be in the mess with your partner. That's my guess. Okay, here's the thing that I like to share with people, because I can't share it with anybody else. My dog doesn't care. The business of the long-term committed relationship is working out the problems that are caused by the relationship. That's what we do. That's the real business. Coming together in this rule-driven contract creates problems. It creates problems of where to live, how to live, how to supply that living, how to put a roof, how to create shelter, how to buy food, how to educate children. Problems, problems, problems. It doesn't solve problems, it only creates problems. And what we do, the actual business of day in and day out life, is let's solve this problem today. This problem of, it can be everything from you left the lid off the peanut butter last night and the dog got it, to is our sex life dead? Right? Everything from between that and that. And the rock that we continue to push uphill is that piece of business right there. You can run from it, And that's an okay choice. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing right about it either. But you, or you can stay there and deal with it. What I think happens is if you stay and deal with it is that gradually over time you become a more complex person. A more complex person. I think. That's me. That's just me. Yeah. I'm saying you grow up.
Right.
Yeah. Understood. Anybody have any comments about that? That the business of relationships is solving the problems caused by the relationship. Yeah.
Well, there are some long-term goals, and I think the more successful marriages are when two people start off looking in the same direction rather than looking at each other. Mm-hmm. And traditionally, one of the goals of marriage is to raise children, and then you have a family that is a hunting family, and this is a great pleasure to be able to get older and to establish a place in the community and going after all that ground helps a lot too. So there are these long-term goals, and I guess having good sex is a very important one to begin with, but that tends to fade away after 2 years, and there are biological and hormonal correlates with that that obviously originated with the hunter-gatherers who needed, the woman needed a man to support her at least for several years while the baby was weaned and so on. So we're dealing with an inheritance of, which is a mess, actually, and it was evolved to help people, help individual communities survive in small groups in a hostile environment with a high death rate. And now we're in a very different situation, and I guess we're following now to look around that. But I do think the long-term goals in a marriage is something that are essential to each of the beginners. And maybe it's just surviving and being successful in life and not having conflicts with the person.
Yeah, one of the biggest problems that with that people confront in these relationships is when kids leave home. You know, then it's like, what do we do now? You know, because you realize that all of this energy that has been involved in getting kids raised and educated and out the door and all of that energy, you know, it's like when the other side stops pulling on the rope, you know, I think that is a very big, and it's an existential problem. This is like, how do we give meaning to our life together now? How do we devote ourselves to what's going on right now, to what seems so empty with kids gone? It seems so empty now. How do we infuse this emptiness with meaning?
Part of it as you get older is to build up relationships with your children and spouses and grandchildren.
Right. Right. Yes, exactly. Like the philosopher's form.
Right. Right.
So did you, your talk is sort of focused on the relationship as if the man and the woman were equal. And in our society and many other societies, it's really a big power difference. And it's a lot easier for a man to leave a relationship than for a woman. Traditionally, because the way we structure relationships, we don't have to do it that way, but that's historically how it's evolved. So it seems to me that there needs to be some comment about that power difference and how to manage it in your the way you focus on how to solve this problem, or maybe not.
I don't want to.
Okay. Is there another question?
But I wonder if you could expand on that. I mean, if you got some more to say about it.
No,
about the power.
I just think it's, I can remember, it's not as true now as it was, let's say, 25 or 30 years ago because many more women
yeah.
have careers now.
Right.
But certainly 25 years ago was much less common. And so for a woman, her livelihood depended on trying to
yeah.
maintain the relationship in ways that for the man, it really didn't matter.
Yeah.
So that it was, you know, for a man to change relationships every 7 years was maybe not such a big deal, but for a woman, it was a very big deal. And while it's changed to some extent, and women are much more independent now than they were 25 years ago, we still have a society in which there's substantial sexist structures that exist. And so it still is harder, I think, for a woman to leave a relationship than for a man. Leave a relationship, and there are physical differences as well, which is why we have shelters for abused women, but very few shelters for abused men. And so, and so it seems to me that in dealing with marital interaction, something needs to be said about that power difference. But you really, the way you describe the situation, is as if they are equals.
Yeah, and I
and it just seems to me that there's a sense in which they're not really.
Okay.
Yeah. In this world today, I mean, women are seem to be the majority of the workforce, and they certainly have as good jobs as men do these days. And myself, I have three exes, and all of them have been active.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you are very, that whole attitude is not considered politically correct enough, but it was not in the world. That's no longer recognized.
Well, that's correct.
Yeah.
I think that they may not be popular, but that we often not like to be who we are.
Well, right now, the best schools are graduating, so are you, and the universities are graduating. The whole university is going to know you make a living. So
oh.
I don't think that women would think of themselves as being inferior as to the law.
Women are telling guys to get out all the time.
Right.
I mean, you know.
You'll find a divorce more often than.
Say that again.
Also,
say that again.
Women are filing for divorce at least twice as often as men. And the other thing I would say is that men who win arguments with women are out of the usual. No sex to men. This is not only true for human societies, it's true for animal societies as well. No sex for men who win arguments.
Wait a minute, I don't have anything to write that. Go ahead.
Well, you're talking about like dual long-term relationships to find an existential sense of meaning in life. I think that we would also address that those of us who live most of the lives about finding the long-term relationship who have found, you know, the life of yourself has been in the
Yeah, okay. Now, I certainly didn't want to make it sound like I'm here to tell you that the only way to find meaning in life is by being in a long-term committed relationship. It is probably one of the most common ways. And have you ever been in a long-term relationship? Ever? Huh? Variously. Okay, so at times you have been in a long-term committed relationship. Yes. Yeah.
And people obviously
you know, at the end of Memories, Dreams, and Reflections by Carl Jung, his autobiography, I don't know if anybody's ever read it or not, but he did take on the problem of love. And there he says that love is the most complex, confounding, and most difficult problem he encountered in his career. And he said he only knows, and I'm going back in memories, but the only thing he could say about it is to allow yourself to succumb to it. To allow yourself to succumb to it. That was about as far as he could go. That, you know, love begins as, in this context, begins as a profoundly physical experience, a profoundly, completely all-encompassing physical experience that then changes over time so that over time, what you learn how to do is that love then becomes the business of staying in the business of solving these problems together. I don't want to. It's beyond my capacities here tonight to comment intelligently about love. And I want to talk more about what the day in and day out business of it. You're asking a very good question, and it requires more expansiveness than I've got with me tonight. Yeah. 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 Never studied arranged marriages, so I don't know a lot about that. What I think I know about arranged marriages is one of the things that it's assumed is you get to keep on being the person you always were if you're a man. But if you're a woman, you're the handcuffs are on you in arranged marriages. That's what I think I remember. I want to keep on. There's a couple of more of these comments that I want to make, and then we'll have to conclude. One of the things that people believe early in life is early in the long-term committed relationship is that you and I, we're going to work real hard together, and we're going to solve all of our problems, and then we're going to be happy. What I have come to understand is that the problems that confront us in our relationships are the glue of the relationship. Without problems, the relationship falls apart. Without problems to solve, without tasks to attend to, the relationships become empty, joyless, meaningless. People start running around on one another because that's where the problems are. You know, how to sneak around without getting caught. How to have sex with that person in the hotel room and cover your tracks. See, that's all kind of, you know, that's all kind of buzz and excitement and problems to solve. When there's no problems here for us to solve, it ends. So as long as there's problems to solve, then you have a relationship that is workable and functional. And people that, well, I'm getting ready to repeat myself, but the problems are the glue of the relationship. Relationship, to me, do not begin until problems happen. Early on, when everything is great, biochemically driven, so forth and so on, it's a dance of bodies. It is instinctual. It is biochemical. It is written into our genes. It's only when problems like, why did you look at me that way? Or don't use that tone of voice on me. Or don't give me that look. Or why did you say that? That's when this collision is starting, and that's when the relationship is beginning, and that's when intimacy is beginning. Prior to that, it has been something else. It has been an engagement of, I guess you could say, an engagement of egos. I'm going to tell you, my wife and I have been having the same fights 35 years. I mean, it's some form of the same fight over and over again. And I think that if you really think about it, if you've been in a really long-term relationship, you'll notice that every relationship has its stamp of individuality that is characterized by the same struggles again and again and again. In other words, the two of us together, we're working as hard as we possibly can to solve an unsolvable problem. And that doesn't mean that since we can't solve that problem, we shouldn't be together. It just means that that is part of our glue. It's part of how we work together. It's part of it's the thing that we do. Anybody got any anecdotal or, you know, any experiential? Yeah.
What's the other problem? And I honestly do not remember.
Yeah.
But I am not saying, well, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Somebody over here said that's age.
Well, I can offer an anecdote. My younger sister had a long wedding earlier this year, and I talked to her and my mother-in-law, and I said, you know, and there were all these wonderful things said at the reception, and someone said, have you ever had any arguments? And both of them said, no, we never had any arguments. So I don't know what sort of problems they were facing or not solving.
They were having the problem of not having arguments. And that's a real problem. That's a terrible problem, because that means that, you know, that here's a, people that avoid conflict, all they ever get is conflict. And most of it is unspoken and inside themselves. Yeah. Okay, we're at 8:30. You know, there's more that I haven't covered on the sheet, on the handout. But, you know, I'm going to stop anyway. My email address is on there if you want to send me an email and ask questions about anything we talked about or anything that we didn't talk about or anything that's towards the end here. Feel free. I'd be happy to return your email. Thank you for being a great audience. I've had a good time.